From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Scott Tong. It's Here and Now. California Governor Gavin Newsom won a decisive victory yesterday against a recall effort. Here's his speech last night.
I'm humbled and grateful to the millions and millions of Californians that exercised their fundamental right to vote and express themselves so overwhelmingly by rejecting so much of the negativity that's defined our politics in this country over the course of so many years.
Newsom's main opponent, conservative talk show host Larry Elder, conceded defeat, even though Elder made baseless claims of voter fraud during the campaign. For more, we have Scott Schaefer, senior political editor at member station KQED. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Scott. How are you?
Now, you were watching the votes pour in last night. The earlier poll suggested it might be a really close, potential dead heat, and then Newsom won handily. What happened?
Well, a lot of people voted early, Scott. You know, in California, everybody got a ballot about a month ago. 22 million ballots went out, and we know that 8 million or more voted by Monday. And so election officials were able to process those ballots, which they're not allowed to do in some states. Some states, you can't even open the envelope until election day. So things got processed quickly, and Newsom suddenly, by 8:20, just 20 minutes after the polls closed, was out to a more than 2 million vote margin lead. The recall was being decisively defeated, and so it just really was clear that Democrats got out and voted, and not enough Republicans did.
Now are the votes still being tallied as we speak? I mean, could this margin narrow?
It could, or it could get bigger. All the ballots that came in by mail or provisional ballots on Tuesday, those are going to start being counted today. So, and as long as they were postmarked by yesterday, all those ballots will be counted.
All right. Now Gavin Newsom, at a late hour in this campaign, brought in a pretty big name, Joe Biden, to help him campaign. Was his team nervous?
I don't think so. In some ways, the Biden event was a victory lap. I mean, it was very clear by then. Every poll showed the recall being handily defeated. And so it was kind of a cherry on top. I don't think Joe Biden changed anybody's mind.
All right. Let's talk briefly about Larry Elder, the conservative leader in the polling. He's, of course, a red candidate in a blue state. He opposes abortion, the minimum wage. He's a climate skeptic. What does this event tell us about him and his wing of the party?
Well, you know, he's overwhelmingly popular with Republicans. Unfortunately, there's only about 24% of the electorate are Republicans. So being popular with the base is not enough to win a statewide election in California. But Larry Elder likes the spotlight, apparently. And he says he implies that he's running next year, 2022, when Newsom is up for re-election. So I don't think we've seen the end of him.
Okay, so outside of California, is this a test case for anything national politically? We know Larry Elder is connected to Stephen Miller, the immigration restrictionist from the Trump administration. Does any of this resonate outside of California?
Yeah, I think, you know, what won this for Newsom was his handling of the pandemic. You know, the mask mandates, the vaccine distribution. We have a high vaccine rate and a low infection rate, one of the lowest in the country. And he was running against Larry Elder and other Republicans who promised that they would undo those mandates if they got elected. And I think California voters overwhelmingly agreed with the governor in his terms of his policies on the pandemic. And I think last night was a real endorsement of those policies and a repudiation of going in the other direction.
All right. And finally, Scott, what is next for Gavin Newsom? He's got another year or so. He took a big hit for going maskless at a very fancy restaurant in California. I mean, does he have some patching up to do? What's on his list?
You know, I think when you win by the kind of margin you did yesterday by beating back this recall, there's nothing to make up for. The election's over. But California still has some very serious problems. We talked about the pandemic. Homelessness is a huge problem. The governor knows that. The California legislature and the governor have invested billions of dollars. They've got to really start showing some results because people really are frustrated and they've had it with homelessness. And obviously, it's a human disaster as well for those who are on the streets. So I think that's really what Newsom and the legislature, in addition to the pandemic, will be focusing on. Now that this recall is over, one thing that may happen is some legislators, Democrats, today are going to be releasing plans to reform the recall process. And I think that there may be some appetite for that, not just in the legislature, but among voters. I think a lot of people saw this as a tremendous waste of money, $300 million, and a luxury that the state can't afford, not just financially, but also, you know, it was a distraction from so many serious problems that now have to be addressed.
All right. Scott Schaefer, senior editor for KQED's Politics and Government Desk. Thanks, Scott, for taking the time.
You're welcome.
Major developments this week in the investigation of the assassination of Haiti's former president, Jovenel Moïse. The current prime minister, Ariel Henry, has fired the lead prosecutor in the case. The prosecutor, Ben Ford Claude, had been seeking charges against Henry in connection with the July killing of Moïse. Jacqueline Charles has been covering these turn of events and joins us now to explain. She covers Haiti for the Miami Herald. Jacqueline, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
These are stunning developments. Phone records appear to tie Ariel Henry, the current prime minister, to the top suspect in the assassination of Moïse. Can you tell us more about the prosecutor's allegations?
Well, the prosecutor is alleging that there were two phone calls on the morning of July 7th between this key suspect and Ariel Henry, the current prime minister. But I have to tell you, the chief prosecutor has had in his hands for several weeks now. And in those records, it doesn't say. Now, the prosecutor is claiming that there was 7 minutes total in terms of the exchange between Henry and this key suspect, Joseph Felix Badiou, but we are not provided with any details in terms of what they spoke about. Let me just say that this key suspect, Badiou, is not somebody who is unknown. He's had conversations with a number of people, political actors. So it would not be uncommon that he has had conversations with other individuals, but we really do not know. And the chief prosecutor who did this after he had been fired by the prime minister did not provide any additional details in terms of why he thinks that the prime minister needed to be charged outside of two calls that he saw in a call log.
Okay, this is why Prime Minister Henry says this indictment has no legal basis. Does he have the authority, though, to essentially step into a working investigation like this?
I spoke to a former investigative judge yesterday about this, and he told me no, that under the law in Haiti, there are separation of functions. And once an investigation like this has been transferred to an investigative judge, which is the equivalent of a grand jury, a chief prosecutor cannot then pursue his own investigation or demand that immigration bar a prime minister from traveling. You know, there are procedures that he needs to take, and he is completely out of his jurisdiction, even if he had not been fired, to do what he did.
You laid out for us a little bit about this central suspect in this case. He's a former justice official, Joseph Felix Badiou. But what are the alleged ties between Badiou, who is now a fugitive from the law, and Ariel Henry?
I am not sure what the ties between Badiou and Ariel Henry is. Ariel Henry is himself a former minister. I would not be surprised if the two of them know each other. Badiou is known by a lot of people. So this is not somebody, this is not like one of the 18 Colombian suspects who are currently in jail and having a conversation with, the current prime minister. And I'll have to tell you that one of the problems with this investigation from the onset has been that it's taking on sort of this political tone. We've heard other personalities whose names have also been cited, including the head of the president's own political party. This is the problems that a lot of people have with this investigation. It's been more than 2 months since Haitian President Jovenel Moïse was killed in the middle of the night. We are no closer to learning more about who are the real masterminds who paid for this today than we were in those first few days when this information became available, despite the fact that the police have pulled together an investigative report. They forwarded to the chief prosecutor, who, mind you, was sitting on this report for weeks before all of a sudden we're hearing that he's asking for charges to be brought against the current prime minister and for him to be barred from traveling from the country.
This is all so much for a country that has already been through so much. I mean, there was just this other major issue that the country is dealing with, and that's rebuilding after that disastrous earthquake a month ago. So what is the reaction overall from people in the country? I mean, is there hope with all of this chaos and messiness, frankly, that there will be justice brought to this case? Or is it just sowing more political chaos?
You know, a president is dead. And in any country, that is something that is very shocking. But what people in Haiti will tell you is that this is a country where there have been so many deaths that where justice has not been rendered. You know, we have to take into context right now, all of this is happening at a time where you have an ongoing political struggle. And so can Haiti, you know, sustain this power struggle, especially given the fact that it was just hit by a major earthquake just a month ago in the southern region. People are still sleeping in the streets. People are still trying to get basics like potable water. They don't know if they're even going to be able to rebuild their homes. The country really needs stability. You know, there's a gang problem, kidnappings. So really, it's going to be up to the Haitians in the next couple of days and weeks in terms of whether, how does this get resolved? Does it get contained? There's a new prosecutor who's been named, but there is also an investigative judge. Whether or not they're going to have the space, the room, the resources to really dig into this probe and try to get answers about the assassination of the late President Jovenel Moïse on July 7th, which also left his wife seriously wounded.
That was Jacqueline Charles of the Miami Herald. Thank you so much for giving us this update.
Thank you.
After more than a year of stalemate and a leadership void, Lebanon's political parties have agreed this week on a new prime minister and cabinet. The country is deep in debt, with tens of billions of dollars in reserves gone missing. An economic crisis has driven middle-class people into poverty and hunger. And government power grids provide scarce electricity, with even hospitals having trouble keeping the lights on. NPR's Ruth Sherlock covers Lebanon, and she's joining us now from Italy to discuss the developments. Ruth, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Ruth, first remind us of the situation in the country.
Well, the country is really falling apart at a dramatic speed. And by that, I mean that the basic utilities for modern living, the things that we use just to get by, are breaking down. So extreme shortages of fuel mean that people have very little electricity in their homes. Some don't even have running water because water companies don't have enough power to make their pumps work. Hospitals are breaking down. Some barely have the power to keep life-supporting ventilators running. And there are chronic shortages of medicines, like basics, like antibiotics. The country's currency is in free fall, so there's such high inflation that people can barely afford basic goods. Families are skipping meals. And the United Nations says now that more than three quarters of the population are in poverty. You know, most of this has happened to Lebanese just in the last year. But all this time, the country has essentially been without any leadership. The government resigned after that massive explosion, you might remember, last August at the port of Beirut that damaged so much of the capital. And since then, politicians, while the country falls apart around them, have spent their time squabbling over cabinet positions and failing to form a government until now.
Right. One of the things, right, holding up aid to Lebanon was that there wasn't an agreement on a cabinet. Now that there is, can the aid start flowing?
Well, look, it's definitely an important first step, and it's one that many countries like France and the US have pushed for. But it is much more complicated than that in Lebanon. So just to give you some background, Lebanon's crisis is being caused by these deep running problems. Lebanon is a deeply divided sectarian society, and these sectarian rivalries play out in government. So politicians have regularly prioritized sectarian politics over the national public good, and there's been chronic mismanagement in government, corruption, and the frequent waste of state funds. So to answer your question, you know, the new government might unlock some humanitarian aid, but the real financial assistance, those many millions of dollars that would really make a difference to Lebanon, still depend on reforms that donor countries insist on happening before they release any more funds. And I want to say here that many are skeptical that this government is even capable of pushing through these reforms.
Right, right. If the aid does start coming in as well, can the government actually fix these massive problems that the country faces?
Well, you know, like I mentioned earlier, these problems in Lebanon are caused by mismanagement and corruption by its leaders. And the problem here is that while there are some new faces in cabinet, almost everyone there is actually backed by the same political groups and same individuals that caused these problems. Some have been in power since the Civil War. They were warlords in the war and are now top politicians. I spoke with Maha Yahya. She's the director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut about all this. She says, look, unfortunately, many in this government have already shown their lack of willingness to actually put the needs of the country first.
These people continued with a business as usual approach. It literally has taken them 13 months after the Beirut blast to put together this government. It tells you how tenacious they are, how much they're holding on to the reins of power, and therefore I'm very unlikely to undertake the kind of fundamental reforms needed to put the country back on a track for some sort of recovery.
Lebanese people spent months on the streets protesting and calling for fresh faces and for a new, clean leadership. Instead, what they have is the prime minister now, Najib Mikati, for example, is an old-timer that's been in this position twice before. He is also among Lebanon's richest men and is himself plagued by allegations of corruption. And there's just a huge disconnect, a big gap now between the country's leaders and their people. And you can kind of see this in sort of some of the statements. For example, in announcing the new government, the prime minister said that everybody in the Lebanese people are going to have to make sacrifices, which, coming from a billionaire when, you know, most of the population is struggling to feed themselves, you know, wasn't exactly well received by many Lebanese.
There's also something else, Ruth. The state is not the only actor in all of this, right? The Lebanese group Hezbollah, which the U.S. considers a terror organization, is also really influential in this crisis. Can you talk about them for a moment?
Hezbollah, you know, while being on the U.S. terror list, is also a political party with a lot of support and influence in Lebanon, as well as being a militia. Hezbollah is represented in government, and some of the cabinet ministers are close to them. But they've got their own parallel operation going, too. So the group's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, announced that the group is actually sourcing fuel for Lebanon. Remember, there are huge fuel shortages in Lebanon, from the group's backer, Iran. And this week, an Iranian fuel ship docked in nearby Syria, and that fuel is meant to be brought overland to Lebanon to try to evade US sanctions. Now, getting fuel into Lebanon when the government has failed to do so would be kind of a PR coup for Hezbollah, or that's the way Hezbollah sees it. You know, they say they're going to donate the fuel, a part of the fuel shipment, to government hospitals and nursing homes and orphanages. The US, for its part, has been trying to source fuel for Lebanon, and one of its interests certainly will be countering Hezbollah and trying to stop that PR coup.
That's NPR's Ruth Sherlock. Thank you so much for this update, Ruth.
Thank you very much.
For decades, researchers have protected rare plant species by preserving their habitats. But given climate change and limited water resources, some experts say protecting land is not enough. In Georgia, conservationists are trying something new. They're saving the seeds of endangered plants and learning about them in the lab, with the hope of one day finding them new homes. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Grant Blankenship has the story.
The brambles are thigh high as researchers explore territory about 50 miles north of the Florida Panhandle.
We're going to walk into a forested wetland that has a lot of tupelo and red maple in it.
Lisa Genke is a plant ecologist here at the Jones Center at Itchaway. She leads this team through what once was a hunting preserve owned by the Woodruff family of Coca-Cola fame. Now it's owned by the charitable Woodruff Foundation. In this group are scientists from the Georgia Department of Natural Resources, the DNR, and private landowners. And they're looking for an endangered plant called the pondberry.
Starts here and goes to, like, the tall sweet gum over there.
Mm-hmm. So the rhizomes are this long.
We found the female plants. They might be clones of each other, really just one plant. That's because genetic reproduction requires male plants, too, and male and female pondberry plants keep their distance. The males are somewhere on the other side of the wetland. That's why pondberry is one of 14 federally endangered plants in Georgia. Today's Nature Walk has an important goal: to collect seeds, stock away those seeds in seed banks, and hopefully one day in the future, put plants back on the landscape. Some call it rewilding. It's not new work, but there will be more projects like this through the help of a five-year, $780,000 federal grant. The aim today is to find this relative of sassafras. Pondberry grows to about 4 feet tall, with fuzzy leaves, zigzag stems, and today, lots of tiny, unripe green fruit. There shouldn't be seeds to collect for months. But then DNR botanist Carly Stepp sees something really cool.
There's red fruit.
Already?
Yeah. Okay.
There's one red, ripe fruit. And that means there's a seed. And so a debate ensues. Collect the seed or not. Lisa Genki says this is the only spot on Itchaway they've seen pondberry.
So we just take one tornado or one hurricane and this population could be gone.
The debate is tabled to look for that stand of male plants across the water. That's where retired science teacher and timberland owner Heather Brazel whips out a tiny magnifying glass to study the details in a pondberry stem.
And those were look a little bit more like your fruiting.
About 70% of Georgia woodland is privately owned. Much of that's monocropped in pine tree plantations. So Brazel says private landowners, even people with just a patch of garden, need to make space for rare plants.
So the idea is that little areas can collectively become significant in terms of conservation and habitat.
An important part of this project is determining the best place to plant the seeds the group will collect. But DNR's Lisa Cruz says that's a ways off.
We're not to the point where we have a notion of where that would be at this point. More now, it's more just protecting the genetic resources.
Back at the female pondberry.
Is it red enough?
They check that single red, ripe berry again. They need to decide whether to take it or leave it.
I think it's red enough, yeah.
Cruz delicately plucks the fruit, slips it in an envelope.
This is like the famous fruit right now.
And then someone asks, hey, is this the first seed of the project?
Yes.
That's exciting! One.
One precious seed. Hopefully the first of many. For Here and Now, I'm Grant Blankenship.
The Justice Department is now asking for a temporary stay in the Texas abortion law, which bans abortions after 6 weeks. But some companies based in Texas are already responding to the new law, which is the strictest in the nation. The software company Salesforce is offering to relocate its Texas-based employees and their families if they have concerns about the law and their ability to obtain reproductive health in that state. Let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, for more. Hey, Robin.
Hey, how are you, Tanya?
I am well, thank you. So Salesforce has several locations in the U.S., including Dallas. What did the company's CEO say about this Texas abortion law and the offer to help relocate its employees?
He actually tweeted, quote, "If you want to move, we'll help you exit Texas. Your choice." This after Salesforce slacked employees that if they and their families are concerned about the ability to access reproductive care in Texas, that the company will help them relocate. I mean, after all, remote work has been a huge part of Salesforce's new normal. It's prominently based in San Francisco, but no shortage of employees have recently decamped to places like Austin, Texas. And as you mentioned, it has many employees in Dallas. And like many big players, it wants to recruit and maintain high-priced talent.
Mm-hmm. This isn't the first time, though, that Salesforce has waded into politics. They've spoken out as a company, right?
Yeah, 6 years ago, notably, when Salesforce threatened to pull back from investing in Indiana as clients and employees weren't so happy about the state's Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which would potentially allow businesses to deny services to LGBTQ people on religious grounds. So Salesforce had previously acquired a company in Indiana. It did, however, relent. And the governor who signed the bill was none other than Mike Pence, who would become the vice president.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking, Robin, about how so many tech companies have flocked to Texas in recent years. How is the rest of the tech industry responding to this abortion law?
It's really blindsiding those who thought booming Austin, you know, with its brisket right. and music and blue-mindedness was just a no-brainer swap for the West Coast. There are all these tax refugees from New York and California that are howling about it. But you've yet to see anyone truly threaten a commercial boycott of the state, which is the planet's ninth largest economy. It has 50 Fortune 500 companies, Dell, Exxon, AT&T, American Airlines. And the thinking is that Texas has the clout for now.
Yeah. We also saw that Tesla CEO Elon Musk, who recently moved to Texas, said that he'd prefer to stay out of politics on this issue. But big picture, when companies like Salesforce take a stand on political issues like this, does it actually move the needle or bring about action from politicians? And I have about a minute with you.
It takes a snowballing of pressure with customers and companies both truly in on it. Think back at apartheid in South Africa. A good 30 years of European consumers leaning on supermarkets to stop sourcing food from South Africa, or British students forcing Barclays Bank, a major multinational, to pull out of the nation. You go on YouTube, Tanya, play the 1985 song Sun City. You know, by the time apartheid fell and Nelson Mandela was getting out of prison, there was no doubt that this kind of commercial isolation had the population, the white population of South Africa, tired and kind of crying uncle. So that's what it takes, not just tweets and press releases here and there.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
The new film, The Killing of Kenneth Chamberlain, dramatizes an almost 10-year-old police shooting that still resonates today. In the early morning of November 19, 2011, police in White Plains, New York, were called to the apartment of Kenneth Chamberlain, a 68-year-old black retired Marine. Chamberlain had accidentally triggered his life aid alert button while he was sleeping, and the company sent the police to check on him. Here's a scene from the film.
Do you have anyone else in your unit with you? Are you by yourself?
No one else here.
All right, well, we got a call about a possible medical emergency.
And I'm telling you, I do not have an emergency, and I didn't call anybody.
Despite Chamberlain's assurances that he was all right, the situation escalated. Officers broke in, tasered him, and shot him with live ammunition. He later died at the hospital. The Killing of Kenneth Chamberlain opens in theaters and on demand Friday, and joining me now is Chamberlain's son, Kenneth Chamberlain Jr. I'm sorry, sir, for your loss.
Thank you. Thank you.
I want to ask about this scene we've just heard of. The police are knocking at your father's door. Tell us a little bit more what happened next.
They arrived at his apartment. They knocked on the door. My father came to the door. He said, "I didn't call you. I'm fine." Now, we know that there's three times that you can make entry into someone's home. It is with permission, with a warrant, or exigent circumstances. They didn't have any. So, and you were there for a medical emergency, so there was no need for you to try to come inside there after he said that he was all right. But for over 90 minutes, they would bang on the door, they would yell at him, they would scream at him, they would mock his military service. At one point, you hear him tell one of the officers, "I'm telling you, I'm all right." And the officer responds saying, "I don't give an F," and uses the N-word.
Now, we hear your voice on the phone at one point in the film here. I mean, what are your specific memories of conversations with your father that morning?
I actually did not speak to my father that morning. You know, that was just the creative licensing piece right there. I actually received a phone call from a friend of mine that also lives in the building. He called me and he said, "You need to get over here right away." And when I asked him why, he said the police were banging on my father's door. And I asked why, and as soon as he was about to say, "I don't know," he yelled out, "Oh my God." And I asked what happened, and he said, "I think the police just shot your father." Outside of that, the life aid monitoring station suggested to the police that they contact me, said, "Call his son." And the police department refused to do so.
Wow. And some of this is captured so dramatically and humanly in this film. Let's listen to a part where your father's niece is approaching an officer outside of his apartment door.
"You know, he has a heart condition, and sometimes he doesn't think right. You know, he imagines things."
"Does he have any weapons in his apartment?"
"I don't know. I don't think so."
"Anyone else in there with him?"
"I doubt it. You could talk to my mama. She might be..."
"No, thank you, ma'am.
You don't want to talk to..."
"So thank you for the help."
So, Kenneth, what's important about this moment, this tone here by the police officer?
I think that it's very, very accurate. Although you change names because it's a fictional narrative due to pending litigation and things like that, my cousin, who lives upstairs, did come downstairs. And she did ask the police officers to let her talk to my father, and they refused. And you also hear on the actual audio where they ask my father if he has family, and you can hear my cousin in the background yell out, yes, he does.
And they ignore that.
They were there on a medical call, and their job is to defuse a situation, but all they did was create one.
Yeah. Now, your father had diagnosed mental health issues. Can you talk a little bit about that and how the police response might have gone a little differently if that were known?
And here we go. Also, they knew. If you listen to the actual tapes, yeah, and the actual calls of that day, they tell him that they're responding to a medical emergency, and they also classified him as an EDP, an emotionally disturbed person. So you knew what you were responding to. This is just a classic example of race and class playing a role in how you respond to different neighborhoods in cities.
Mm. And this event occurred a decade before far more publicized incidents, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd. What has it been like for you to watch these victims?
It's trauma. I relive the trauma. I mean, even speaking about what happened to my father, that's reliving the trauma over and over and over again. And unfortunately, we have a system of justice that's in place that doesn't place any value on the lives of Black or brown people. So we are constantly fighting. We're constantly trying to get some semblance of justice. And here we are now, November 19th makes 10 years, a decade. And I've come to the conclusion that there will never be justice for Kenneth Chamberlain Sr. All I can hope for is some type of accountability.
Yeah, well, as you describe, it has been almost 10 years that you have been seeking to hold the police officers accountable, right? No criminal charges were brought. You filed a civil suit that is ongoing. The district attorney of White Plains, New York wants to take another look here. Do you think possibly that the events of the last year, notably the murder conviction of Derek Chauvin and the death of George Floyd, may potentially help your case?
I think it's great that the district attorney is taking a second look at the case. And definitely, given the current climate with George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, it's kind of forcing some of these elected officials and prosecutors to look at some of these cases again. I'm hoping that this current DA, Mimi Rocha, will look at it. And if she sees something and it's a chargeable offense, you know, I welcome it, because I don't want people to believe that the conviction of Derek Chauvin in the killing of George Floyd, that conviction is the blueprint to how to fight injustice or extrajudicial killings and summary executions. That conviction represents accountability on the smallest level, but not justice, because there can be no justice when the rates of shootings and killings remain steady.
Hmm. You have been very public speaking out about your father's case, writing in newspapers about the situation. This film is now out. What do you hope this accomplishes in the public conversation?
I'm hoping that it's going to kind of reignite the conversation. I mean, here in New York State, you had task force that were put together to reimagine and redevelop what policing could look like, but we still haven't seen any real significant changes. And at the very least, if nothing else, I want this film to be a teaching tool of what not to do. You don't do that.
Can I ask you if this film for you, I mean, you work, has it been hard to watch?
It's hard to watch every time I watch it. And I've been to film festivals where we've won awards for it. But each and every time I see it, tears fall from my eyes.
Yeah. And finally, can I ask you to share just a couple additional memories of your father for those who are interested in this film?
It's interesting because I've had conversations and someone said to me, you know, don't tell me about what happened to your dad while he was killed. Tell me something that makes you smile, that makes you laugh about your dad. And I always go back to a day that I graduated from high school. They called my name, Kenneth Chamberlain Jr., and people were clapping, but I could still hear my father's voice over everyone. And I made contact with him, and he threw his hands up in the air and yelled, yes, and dropped to his knees. And it was just, you know, something that was, you know, I've never forgotten it. I mean, my dad was my superhero. He was a man of integrity, a man of honor, and what happened to him shouldn't have happened.
Kenneth Chamberlain Jr., his father's death at the hands of police is the focus of the new film, The Killing of Kenneth Chamberlain. Kenneth, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Janet Fiore, who was the district attorney in the case of Kenneth Chamberlain, has said that the original case was extensively investigated, and both state and federal investigators looked at the facts and determined independently not to pursue charges in the Chamberlain case. We reached out to the White Plains Police Department, but no response yet. It is election time in Canada. You'll be forgiven for not knowing the whole campaign will last just 36 days total. There's an idea. Voting will take place on Monday to choose the next prime minister. It pits the current prime minister, Justin Trudeau, who also heads the Liberal Party, against Conservative Party newcomer Erin O'Toole. This is what's called a snap election. For more, we have Chris Hall from the CBC in Toronto. He hosts a weekly political show, The House, and he is national affairs editor at the CBC. Welcome, Chris.
Well, thank you, Scott. Good to be with you.
All right, question one. What is a snap election, and why did Justin Trudeau call it now?
Well, we have a minority government here, which means that the Liberals didn't have enough seats compared to the opposition to push through their agenda unfettered. It would require some compromise. And Justin Trudeau called this election, which he has the right to do, arguing that Canadians deserved a voice at this point to talk about how this country emerges from the pandemic, to set a path forward for things like a universal $10 a day child care plan, more aggressive targets to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to 40% to 45% below 2005 levels by 2050. These are the kinds of issues he felt would help create a winning condition for him to go from a minority situation to have that majority government, which would give them a much freer hand to push legislation through Parliament.
Okay, I see. So he thought this maybe was a good political moment to push a potential advantage here. Now, as I understand it, there are at least five major candidates on the ballot, but tell us about the two main rivals here and a little bit more about what they're saying. Justin Trudeau for the Liberals, Erin O'Toole for the Conservatives. Maybe talk first about Erin O'Toole.
Sure. He is a relatively new leader, elected a year ago by party members to lead the Conservative Party. He has taken it more to the center of our political spectrum, softening some of the harder edges that the Conservatives had on things like immigration, on things like social policy, abortion stands and the like. He has said that we will not re-litigate the abortion issue while he is in power, if he is in power. He's also really, I think, tried to establish himself as still true to some of the rural roots or the more suburban roots of the Conservative Party historically. He would not proceed with $10 a day universal child care. Instead, he would give a tax credit to families directly to them so they could spend the money as they chose. He would stick with the original 30% reduction targets for climate change in gases instead of the more aggressive 40 to 45% talked about by the Liberals and supported by the other parties, I would add. Justin Trudeau, maybe a better known commodity. He obviously was Prime Minister during the renegotiations, the North American Free Trade Agreement. He and Chrystia Freeland, who is his Deputy Prime Minister now, stood up, I think, for many Canadians' viewpoint to Donald Trump and some of the things that he had said, both during the negotiations, but also these national security tariffs he imposed on aluminum and steel here in Canada. Interesting, the two of them, Trudeau and O'Toole, have some very fundamental differences when it comes to foreign policy. Erin O'Toole would like to create a special committee of parliament that would have nothing but on its agenda but Canada-U.S. relations. Justin Trudeau used to have a cabinet committee on Canada-U.S. relations, now has broadened it out to more global security issues. O'Toole would take a much harder line with China than Justin Trudeau has. He would ban Huawei, for example, from participating in our 5G network. The Liberal government of the day still trying to make a decision on that.
So a lot of substance on the agenda here, but for a moment I have to ask you about Gravelgate. Last week on the campaign trail, Justin Trudeau said, I'm not going to back down from anti-vaxxer mobs. And then what appeared to be an anti-vaxxer mob threw gravel at him as he was boarding a bus. How's that all played?
Yeah, and an individual has been charged for throwing the gravel at him. He wasn't hurt, just in case your audience was worried about that. Look, it's been an interesting dynamic. There is a strong but relatively small persistent audience that's opposed to mandatory vaccinations or vaccine passports that we're talking about here that would require – that people would be required to go to non-essential services, for example, to a pub or to a theater or to a sporting event. And this has been a very vocal and very un-Canadian kind of protest movement, insofar as that the people who have been showing up are shouting, in some cases, racial epithets at some of the security around him. They have been very vocal in casting aspersions on him and the kind of language they have used, profanity that we're not really accustomed to in this country. He has begun to push back, Justin Trudeau. I'm not sure how ultimately it will play out in the election campaign in terms of voters' choices on Monday, but there are some people who believe that it was about time that he did fight back and to tell people, you are holding us back as a country, being able to have the kinds of vaccination rates that will allow us to open up the economy more quickly. So it's become a bit of an issue. And I would point out that Erin O'Toole and every other candidate has condemned the violence, condemned the language that's been used at these campaign stops where protesters have confronted him.
All right. And very quickly, Chris, this could be close, yeah?
Oh, yeah, it's really close. The polls show a statistical dead heat. I will say, just to bore people for a second, the Liberals have a better chance of getting more seats with the same level of popular support because their vote is more efficient. The Conservatives tend to win some ridings by huge margins and lose others by very narrow ones.
Oh, yeah, I understand. Can win the popular vote and still, you know, not capture the parliament. That is Chris Hall at CBC, where he is National Affairs Editor and host of the show The House. Chris, thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.